ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if the most ordinary things in your life aren't ordinary at all? A toothbrush, the pockets in your jeans, even a gravestone. Someone designed them, shaped them, argued over them, and got it so right, you've stopped noticing. The everyday is full of hidden ingenuity, and on By Design with me, Anthony Burke, we pull it all into the light. Search for By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It might not feel like it to everyone, but the Australian economy is doing extraordinarily well, according to the Treasurer.
Private sector investment in Australia is booming. The biggest through-the-year rise in machinery and equipment investment in more than two decades. Data centre investment was a big part of the story, but we've also seen renewable energy and battery storage.
But were it not for an avalanche of spending on AI-equipped data centres, this week's national accounts would have been much, much worse, much weaker economic growth in the quarter of the year that took in the US attack on Iran. And almost certainly even weaker economic growth in the quarter to follow. Weak enough to be, or feel like, a recession. If it was a recession, if it turns out to be one, what would that mean for us? And how far away from one are we? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, urban economist Terry Rawnsley, who's something of an expert in whether or not we're in recession. He's prepared state-by-state and city-by-city estimates going back years, and also estimates for the years before Australia had official records. Terry's the Director of Planning and Infrastructure at KPMG Australia. And Diana Messina, who's been examining the official economic growth figures each quarter for the past 15 or so years, first at the Commonwealth Bank and now the AMP, where she's Deputy Chief Economist. Welcome back, Diana, and welcome back, Terry.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to be here, Peter.
Diana, the GDP figures tell us both about the size of the pie and about who's getting what slice of it. Can we look at the size first, as described by the figures that came out on Wednesday? What do we know about economic growth? How much the pie grew during the first quarter of the year, the quarter that includes the start of the war?
Well, the economic pie has been doing pretty well in Australia. In the year to March, the Australian economy expanded by 2.5%, about a 0.3% increase over the quarter. So not that strong over the quarter, but we have seen a few prior periods where growth was pretty good. So overall, our economy at $2.8 trillion is, or has been, doing relatively well.
How much of that was due to an explosion in spending on data centres in Sydney and Melbourne?
A lot of it. So about 0.7 percentage points was due to the increase in machinery.
Hang on, that's more than the growth.
Correct, but you have to account for the impact of imports. So a lot of the data centre fit-out, which is the phase that we're in right now, is very import intensive, which makes it a bit more neutral on a quarterly basis. It's still good for the long term, though.
What do we know, Terry, about the breakup of the pie? We're not all working on data centres. What do we know about who's got what?
We did see, you know, a lot of industries actually expand, but not a lot. And when you sort of look at the contribution to growth, we had manufacturing up 0.1 percentage points, construction on the data centres, professional services, which is related to engineering and design and computer services. They're ones were kicking up. And then we had poor old mining going back a bit, but that was more due to some rough weather, meaning we couldn't get our exports out of Australia. And then, of course, we had transport, postal and warehousing, which went backwards, and that's on the back of that increase in fuel prices.
And what about us? What about our spending, Diana? We account, that's our consumer spending, for about half of all the activity in the economy.
Yeah, there's multiple ways to look at this. You know, people often say to me, well, what about me? What slice of the pie do I get? And there is actually an indicator for that. I mean, economists have an indicator for basically everything, but this is one that I like to look at. It's the wage and the profit share of the income produced from the economy. So there's an expenditure way of measuring the economy, there's an income way, and then there's a production way. So if we think about the income, the wage share of that income has actually been rising in the past few years, and it's lifted to about 54%. So more than half of the increase in GDP is due to the increase in wages growth that we've had. So consumers are getting a pretty good slice of that pie. Now, for the March quarter, the consumer spending figures overall were a little bit softer on the discretionary side. There was a lot of hoarding of food and fuel, which lifted essential spending, but the discretionary bit was soft.
We were filling our pantries and our cars more than we normally would.
And that helps to increase growth.
Until next quarter, when we sort of start to run down the cans of baked beans and empty out the jerry cans of fuel, then it's a bit of a detraction next quarter.
There was a special report this time from the Bureau of Statistics on illegal tobacco. Its findings would probably shock listeners to this program. Just a fortnight ago, we heard that illegal tobacco accounted for 60% of cigarette sales. Deanna, what did the Bureau find? Oh, and how did it find it?
Well, it found that the number of illicit tobacco products is more like 80% now. And
80%, up from 60.
Yeah.
A different measurement. They did this one with, how can I put this politely? I think the term they use is wastewater analysis to look for indicators of nicotine in sewerage. They did a lot of other things as well. What's happening generally, according to them, to smoking?
Well, this is all because of the very steep increases in the tobacco excise that we've had. I mean, from a GDP point of view, though, the ABS said that because a lot of these products are imported, similar to the data centers, there's a bit more of a neutral impact to the consumption figure. So you get this decline in consumption because people aren't spending on legal tobacco, but then you also don't get the import impact. So from a growth point of view, I wouldn't say it's particularly important. I mean, it's important from a government revenue perspective, but from growth, it's just a very small share of the market.
Also, they say because there's such a low price for what's a fairly long-term record high in cigarette smoking, they say that's another reason why it won't much affect the gross domestic product. I suppose there's still serious reason to be concerned, Terry, or living in Melbourne as you do. Do you not regard this as new information?
No, I think just my lived experience seeing the amount of tobacco stores kind of reinforces what the ABS has found. And I think this is also a really good example of the lengths that the ABS goes to try and get the numbers to sort of help construct the GDP. So they're really going through the wastewater to try and work out what's happening. And every time something new comes up, the ABS tries to go, well, is there an administrative data source? Is there a survey we can run? Is there something in the tax office we can pull out? And I think this is a good example of scavenging every bit of data you can.
I mean, I personally think this is a complete waste of money. The ABS has cut down on a lot of really good indicators to make way for the monthly CPI and, you know, apparently looking at wastewater to look at illicit tobacco use, but we don't get something like the Housing Occupancy and Costs Survey, which was a fantastic survey about home ownership, the different income quintiles of housing groups, actually important things that matter for the economy.
Even household expenditure, who's doing what? It's been a while since that's been updated.
Yeah, because the money's gone elsewhere.
Taking everything together that has been reported this week, can I ask each of you quickly, Terry first, are we headed toward a so-called recession? Two quarters of negative economic growth. Now, we didn't have it this time, and the data centres helped with that. The next quarter will have to be worse, given that we're going to have more of the war in it. Are we headed toward that so-called technical recession?
Yeah, no, I think we're going to skirt around that. There'll probably be a couple more quarters of this 0.3, 0.4% growth, but I don't think we're going to dip negative at this point, and we probably definitely won't have two in a row. So that's sort of the view that we formed.
Deanna?
It's pretty hard to get there. We've tried to do the numbers to massage them to see how it would look when you go into a two quarters of negative growth. I mean, a lot of things have to go wrong, and you can sort of see one-offs happening, like a big fall in inventories or something like that. But I think it'd be pretty hard to get there.
We were presented with a recession In 1990, the Treasurer Paul Keating made this famous declaration.
First thing to say is that the accounts do show that Australia's in a recession. The most important thing about that is that this is a recession that Australia had to have.
Terry, that stuck in memories in November 1990. But you know what? As it turned out, he was wrong. Not that he would have known it at the time. The Bureau of Statistics, where you used to work on the national accounts, had indeed reported two consecutive quarters of negative growth, of spending and income shrinking. But they revised the data later. There was no recession when the Treasurer said there was. We now know that there was in the following year. They always revise figures as data comes in. That might make people think that this definition is, how shall I say it, too fragile. Perhaps, does it even make much sense?
I try to explain to people that, say the GDP of the country is $100, you know, the movement we're talking about now is 30 cents difference. The margin of error, we ask of the accounts, are pretty precise. And even if you went and asked a particular business about what their quarterly numbers are, they're like, oh, we've got an idea, but we're not very precise because, you know, Terry hasn't submitted all his taxi receipts and his travel expenses from last quarter. So even businesses don't get down to this quarterly level, but we sort of ask the national accounts to give us a best guess about what's happening quarterly. And then we sort of go through this process that we get a lot of data from the tax office, which takes a couple of years to collect and audit, and we get that. So we have this sort of window of a couple of years where the GDP numbers are subject to sort of bigger revisions. And then occasionally you do like what you call historical revisions, where you sort of crack open the 90s and 80s and make sure you don't wipe out a recession by accident.
What should we be looking for, Deanna, if we actually want a guide to, I suppose, something that feels like a recession? We perhaps shouldn't be looking at the minute changes in these growth figures. What should we be looking for?
Well, the best predictor of recession, I think, is the share market. The share market tends to move before the economic data, and a lot of the recessions in recent times, perhaps not in Australia but around the world, like in the US, have been linked to financial market crises. So if the share market is down by 20% from its high, you would call that a bear market. And I think that you would sort of be worried that you'd get into recessionary territory then.
And indeed, even if we have a recession on figures, we have economic growth slightly negative for two quarters, you wouldn't regard that as particularly real unless it was accompanied by a fairly major fall in the share market and probably a rise in unemployment.
I think you need to see all three of those. How far has the unemployment rate moved? What's the share market done? And then what's the growth data done? But it's funny that sometimes by the time you get the official stats from the statistics agencies to say that you've been in outright negative growth for two quarters, the share market has already recovered because it bounces around quite quickly, unless you know it's a really bad recession. The other thing is that we haven't had a proper recession in Australia for more than 30 years, you know, because COVID wasn't a real recession. So it's also hard to say what it would look like from a stats point of view because we haven't had one.
A more fundamental question, and maybe we should have asked this first, is what's so bad about a recession? Look, two quarters of negative economic growth, production, income shrinking. What's so bad about it, Terry?
There's the good old sort of paradox of thrift concept, which I like to roll out, which says, you know, in times of crisis, people might save a bit more money. They might not go out and spend or go on a holiday or upgrade the car or travel, which is good for their household economy. But if everyone does that, the whole economy starts to contract. So I think it's really thinking about that broader psyche and how people are feeling, and that impacts their spending, which then impacts the real numbers.
And is that why, even though people talk about, Deanna, people talk about sometimes, oh, we don't want growth all of the time. If you don't have growth, it can really lead to a very big contraction as people stop spending because they're scared, and businesses lay people off because they're scared.
I think people that say we don't want growth don't understand what the GDP figures are trying to show them. It's not like we're trying to get more and more production and facilities out there. It's just basically showing you how much people are spending in the economy. And even if you just have normal population growth, that will help to lift your GDP figure. So if you don't have growth, guess what? Your living standards are going to go backwards. And like Terry said, you're probably going to lose your job. So we need to have a certain level of economic growth just to keep people's incomes moderate and to keep living standards from rising over time.
Okay, so we really, really don't want a recession. And in recent times, we've become very good at avoiding them in Australia. Why that is and whether that can continue is what we're about to discover on The Economy Stupid, which is the title of this program on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guests, Terry Rawnsley and Deanna Messina. Terry, you've actually gone back and looked for signs of recessions before the official figures began, before there was such a thing as GDP. It began in the 1950s. What's the broad pattern you see, and what sort of indicators did you have to look for?
Because I've got nothing better to do with my time, I do like going back through the dusty ABS yearbooks, and it kind of showed that these major one-off events, so the biggest one that I found was the start of the First World War. So global economy stopped. We had this big outflux of population from the country. Then the next three were sort of the Great Depression, you know, the 1929 to 31, not great times. And then we sort of had this also the end of the Second World War, when sort of war production wound down and the domestic economy hadn't picked back up. And then we kind of get back into the recession of the early 80s and the 91s. And then we kind of had the Spanish flu recession in there as well, the big wool bust in the 50s after the Korean War. So all these sort of, you know, unexpected major global events were the ones that pushed Australia into recession rather than sort of domestic conditions.
What's astounding is that there's been almost nothing since 1990. That is to say, if you were to put, and you have, what you've done on a graph, and I think you use measures such as the number of sheep slaughtered and things such as that, measures that were available, you know, for the last 100 years, what's astounding is you had very big recessions, depressions, and then nothing for 35 or so years. Is that because we've got better at avoiding them?
Maybe we can take a credit for the economics profession that maybe we are marginally better at avoiding recessions. But I think it's also kind of reflecting a diversification of the Australian economy. Back when we sort of literally rode on the sheep's back, it was 30% or more of GDP was in agriculture, and that's impacted by global trade, floods, droughts, and then, you know, periods we had 30% of manufacturing making up the economy. So now we're a much more diversified economy where we have mining, tourism, international exports, data centres. So there's much more diversity in the economy, and sense better to roll with these shocks that we see from time to time.
Deanna, might we, in fact, have consigned recessions or serious ones to the past?
I mean, I hope so to some extent. We've definitely become better at managing them from a policymaker point of view. So besides the fact that our economy is much more diverse, as Terry said, which is so important, the Reserve Bank in managing inflation also smooth the cycles in the economy. So when inflation's too high, they try to reduce it. When inflation's too low, they try to bring it back up. And the government also does this through automatic stabilizers, which work through things like welfare payments and taxes even. So the policymakers have become better at managing the cycles, which I think has also helped. Whether they are a thing of the past, I mean, it's hard to imagine a continuous business cycle where you're going to get solid growth forever. I would still say that there's a 30% probability of a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. So we still have to look out for them because things can go wrong. But I think if it was to happen, it would be short and shallow.
Terry, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, said a long time ago that he looked forward to the days when economists were like dentists. They could fix things. It was a fairly boring job. Have we reached the stage where we can fix things, and is it becoming easier or harder?
We're probably better, using your analogy, at putting a few fillings here and there to get us through the ups and downs of the business cycle. But we've probably gotten a bit worse at that big crown you've got to drop into your mouth now and then. But I think we've gotten much worse at sort of longer term reform, going, how do we grow the economy in the long run, because we have these sort of fits and starts of growth. But then if you look back over the last 5 years, real wages are still down. Per capita household spending is kind of flat. We've kind of just drifted away from that. It's just solid, continual economic growth because the world's changed on us.
Can we feel a recession, our own recession, I suppose, in our bones, Terry? There's an economist in the United States, Justin Wolfers, we've had him on this program, who argues that our answers to those questions, how do you feel, how satisfied would you say you are with your life these days on a scale of 1 to 10, our answers to those questions, in fact, give us a very good read on the health of the economy or the health of the economy for us. He says, in fact, if you compare countries or compare one country over time, they correlate quite strongly with the much more expensive and slow measure of GDP. What do we know about how we Australians are feeling and how that's changed?
The ABS puts out their, it's called the General Social Survey, where they ask these questions about, on a scale of 1 to 10, how are you feeling? In 2019, we were about a 7.5. Last year, when they asked us questions, it was 7.1.
We're feeling worse than 5 years ago.
We're feeling worse, yeah. So people's life satisfaction has fallen. But it's interesting, when you look at those numbers, it also tells you about that quality of life by age group. And it's kind of the 25 to 34-year-olds who are probably feeling less satisfied than they were 5 years ago, because they're the ones struggling with rising rents, they've got big mortgages if they're lucky enough to be in the housing market, they're facing challenges around AI and establishing their careers, whereas the 65-plus cohort, their life satisfaction hasn't really changed in the last 5 years because they don't have those, on average, same challenges to worry about financially.
The average can hide quite a few things. Do you think, Deanna, that we might be in a recession or in for a recession, I suppose, a mental recession, even if the figures don't show it?
I think we've been in one for the past 6 years, because other data like the consumer sentiment figures show a similar trend where people are telling us that they feel depressed, even despite what I would say is fairly good outcomes. We've had an unemployment rate that's still near a 50-year low. I mean, that is great news for the average wage earner, because they can go out, they can pay debt, they can spend on whatever it is that they want. I think it's more that people are feeling disillusioned with policymakers, with politicians, maybe a bit with life as well. I don't know if it's our capitalist society that makes people feel like they're on this, you know, hedonic treadmill, if you want to put an economics turn on it, you know, this churn to try and just get higher incomes, be at the top of their profession, but they're feeling like their life quality is not moving alongside with it. So maybe we need to change our focus a bit.
You've actually published this week a graph I haven't seen before, updated from this week's National Accounts, and it shows that our income, going back to, you know, the start of COVID, we like to think that our incomes, household incomes, have fallen behind, because wages certainly have fallen behind prices, showing that if you take all incomes together, we haven't really, on average, fallen behind. Why does that produce a result which, just measuring the wage growth figures versus the price growth figures, why does that produce a result that doesn't show?
So it basically is looking at total income from everything, not just as a wage earner, but your investment income, for example. So we know that investment returns have been very strong in recent years, both from like a superannuation point of view, or if you've just had other investments in the share market, or if you've been invested in housing. Housing has returned 55% on average across Australia, with a lot of outperformance in areas like Queensland and Perth. So when you take all of that into account and the churn in the labour market, so a wage price index is purely an indicator of the cost of a particular role. So say Deanna, the economist, what is her role going to cost now versus last year? But if I went and...
That was when you were an economist grade two. And if you've got a new job, upgraded to an economist grade five, as people get...
That's right. And the labour market's been so tight in recent years that Deanna, the economist, may have gone and found another job and gotten a promotion and gotten a wage increase.
So one of your messages would be... Get real, people. It's not as bad as you think. But I see within what you've said, what Terry said, which is that as far as I can see, 20s and 30-year-olds don't have many investments in the share market or real estate.
I mean, that's certainly true. That's why we've seen this idea of this K-shaped economy. And
you better explain the K-shape.
The K-shaped economy is basically an economy that is running at two speeds. So you've got the upwards K and the downwards K. The upwards K is driven by people that have assets, people that have wealth. So in Australia, we would say it's the baby boomers who are, you know, riding on the coattails of high home price growth and great returns in their super. And the people on the bottom end of the K is younger households who don't have as many investments, who are probably renting and who have been impacted by rising interest rates. I mean, that's true to some extent, but we can still see that overall wages growth, even for the younger groups, has been at pretty good rates. And we've just seen that this week with the announcements of the Fair Work Commission, and the unemployment rate is still low. And when you go out and about, you can still see young people spending a lot on services, eating out, spending on goods. I don't think it's as bad as some make it out to be.
Do you think people should stop whinging, or young people, and back up, Terry? Or is, in fact, there a good reason to worry about, the K-shape, uneven outcomes?
This is where, for me, it really is interesting about, like, we can show a lot of good metrics about the economy's going okay. If 10 years ago you said to me, unemployment's going to be 4.5%, I was like, that's amazing. What a great outcome. But now people are like, oh, it's not really floating my boat. So there's a bit of a disconnect between the economic statistics, how people are feeling, the quality of life, and that sort of distribution of those opportunities.
I suppose we should be aware that feelings are real. That is, they have worth in their own terms, even if the figures suggest we perhaps should be feeling better than we are. On that somber note, I'll say thank you, Deanna. Thank you, Terry. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Deanna.
I'm going to say Trump's birthday on the 14th of June. So a lot of performers have been pulling out of his birthday celebrations, and Trump is saying that he wants to headline the event himself because he doesn't need all these artists. You know, he's the greatest performer of all time.
He's not going to sing, I hope.
I hope not for our sakes. But I think it's important because I think I said this last time I was on the program that we really needed to see a deal on Hormuz, and the birthday was sort of a bit of an endpoint. Like, he missed his son's wedding because he said, I've got this little thing called Iran going on. He really wants to get a deal done soon with Iran. So I feel like the birthday is maybe a bit of a milestone in that Iran deal.
And if the deal's not reached, I suppose we're going to see much higher oil prices when that temporary cut in the fuel excise comes off. Terry, what are you looking out for?
Probably 10 years ago, the ABS had a publication called Measures of Australia's Progress. So it had a bunch of economic indicators, but also it had sort of environmental accounts, crime, feelings of safety in there. And that was one of the many publications which were cut for budgetary reasons. But I think we almost need to come back to that and go, let's put a big dashboard down about how we're progressing as a nation, because I think there just needs to be a bit of a national conversation about why we're feeling so sad and what can we do about it.
Terry Rawnsley, Director of Planning and Infrastructure Economics at KPMG Australia, and Deanna Messina, Deputy Chief Economist at AMP. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
It was great. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. Paul has done that via the economy.stupid@abc.net.au. He writes about last week's program on tax expenditures, saying that just measuring the amount of money lost from a tax expenditure, say in superannuation, isn't the same as measuring the amount that would be got if a loophole or a tax break was closed because people had moved their money somewhere else. That's quite right, Paul. The Treasury has actually published, not in every tax expenditure statement, but from time to time, revenue gain estimates alongside revenue foregone estimates, and they are lower, but not as low as you would think. I think that's because one of the big tax breaks is the family home, and people have reasons for continuing to own family homes. And, of course, compulsion means that they have reasons for continuing to have superannuation. But that work is done. We're also getting a lot of emails about tax indexation, and we have in mind having a program on it soon. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.